The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest. Okay, let's get started. We ended up last week partially through the medical information. There's one section we missed. I'm going to start off with that today. Electric stimulation turned back the clock. From electroconvulsive therapy, often called shock treatment, to deep brain stimulation, there is a long history of applying electrical currents to the brain to treat neurological and mental health issues. Now two studies suggest the benefits of this type of therapy might be more widespread. In one experiment, researchers used electrodes embedded in a skull cap to deliver an alternating current to certain regions of the brain of 42 adults aged 60 to 76. Doctors know that brain waves tend to fall out of sync with one another as we age. They also theorize that this disconnect is what slows the transfer of information from one part of the brain to another, the areas controlling reasoning and memory, for instance. To test this theory, the researchers tuned their electric currents to the natural oscillations of each subject's brain waves to help them get back in sync. After the treatment, the older adults' scores on tests of their working memory matched the scores of a comparison group of 20-somethings. In another study, an electric current was used to stimulate the vagus nerves as we get older. The branch of the nervous system that controls fight or flight impulses gets more active, while the branch that affects rest and digest function slows down. Together, these changes make us more prone to a wide variety of diseases. Shocking the vagus nerve, that's V-A-G-U-S for information, which helps control breathing, digestion, heart rate, blood pressure, and other bodily functions, rebalanced study participants' nervous systems, helping them counterattack the effects of aging. That sounds great. My only question is it long-lasting or is it just a temporary kind of thing? Okay, let's have a couple laugh lines here. Anyone want to buy some exercise equipment? I'm having a going-out-of-fitness sale. Accidentally went grocery shopping on an empty stomach, and now I'm the proud owner of aisle 7. One of the world's strongest man events should be pulling apart two shopping carts that are stuck together. I'll empathize with that. My wife does this cute thing now and then where she goes out shopping for next year's yard sale items. Two salespeople approached me at the furniture store. I'm following the one who called me Miss. The hello, ma'am one should take note. If I worked in a used record store, I could tell every customer that all sales are vinyl. Oh, that was terrible. Your true stories in 100 words. An ode to Dad. When I was a little girl, my father always let me help him with car and home repairs. Afterwards, he used to say, I couldn't have done it without you. If he deemed a job too dangerous, he would seat me out of harm's way and have me read poetry aloud to him. He insisted this eased his work and would thank me just the same. I didn't write my own poetry until Father's last years. Now I have two published poetry collections and several awards. I couldn't have done it without you, Dad. Laura Grace Weldon, Litchfield, Ohio. The little bird told me. On a self-imposed COVID-19 isolation, oh, that's familiar, I felt increasingly depressed from living alone. After a long, spiritless walk, I remembered to feed the birds before settling in for the evening. Loading the feeder, I noticed a chickadee, my favorite bird, alighting on a nearby branch. As I stepped away, the bird flew to the feeder, pausing on a perch. Looking me straight in the eye, it sang a high-pitched cheep, cheep, then grabbed a seed and flew off. A thank you I'll never forget. Tears welling up, I knew God had not forgotten me. His little messenger reminded me of that. The long and short of it. I'm an 84-year-old gentleman who stands 5 feet 4 inches tall from the basketball crazy state of Indiana. Recently, my wife and I were having dinner at a local restaurant. Our waiter was a young man around 6 foot 8. Naturally, I asked him if he played basketball. He looked down at me and replied, yes, I do. Then asked me if I played miniature golf. Boy, that'd kill your tip real quick, wouldn't it? How about a laughter the best medicine section? At an event famous for giving out awards in bizarre categories, the MC enthusiastically announces, the next prize will go to the laziest person in the audience. If you think you qualify, raise your hand. Everyone raises their hand except a middle-aged man who seems to show little interest. Congratulations, you are the winner, says the MC to the man. Your prize is this $100 bill. Still showing no emotion, the man replies, would you mind coming over here and putting it in my pocket? I was raised by my grandfather clock because my biological clock was never there. Oh, that's terrible. Give me the scoop. Just saw a guy walking down the street eating a gallon of ice cream right out of the container. I hired him as my life coach. My husband just bought ice cream with raisins. So that was a fun marriage. I'm going to start eating clean. How do you wash ice cream? By the way, the ice cream with raisins was probably rum raisin, and the rum offsets any disgust with raisins. I can give you the cause of anaphylactic shock in a nutshell. Oh. A statistician's wife gave birth to twins. Shortly after, he rang the minister, who was delighted. Bring them both to church, he said, and we'll baptize them. No, replied the statistician. Baptize one. We'll keep the other as a control subject. One of the shortest wills ever written. Being of sound mind, I spent all the money. Not making the grade. When you were in high school, did you feel as if your teachers failed to recognize your true talent or potential? This guy would have felt the same. Student, J. Christ, grade 10. English, grade C. Tend to write in archaic forms, saith, maketh, etc., and relies overly on outmoded figures of speech. History, gotta be. Excellent and enthusiastic pupil of ancient history, but is baffled by the modern era. Earth science, incomplete. Totally misinterpreted a major assignment in the Age of Rocks, and instead reported on the Rock of Ages. Needs to repeat. P.E., got a D. A troublemaker. During our unit on swimming, refused to work on technique, and instead tried to walk across the pool. General comments. A charismatic boy, but social concerns persist. Most disturbing is he organized a gang of 12 of his peers. Also, he should keep his hair at a tidy length and not wear sandals, in accordance with the school uniform guidelines. I hope you figured out who that was before I finished. My thank you year. How writing 365 notes of appreciation reconnected me and what's important in my life. In January 2018, I was commuting from Brooklyn to New Jersey. I have two little kids and a busy consulting business, so a quiet train ride felt like a mini-vacation. Yet I found myself spending that precious time slack-jawed, scrolling through my social media feeds. One day I put down my phone and started writing thank-you notes to people who had contributed to a fundraiser I had organized. When I got off the train that day, I was noticing better mood. The next day I wrote more thank-yous and felt the same afterglow. When I finished writing the notes, I counted them up. There were 31, one for every day of the year so far. Something clicked. What if I kept it up? I decided to write one thank you note for every day of that year. I had no shortage of people I was grateful for, so I picked out a different theme for each month to keep on task. January was charity, and thankfully I'd already completed that goal. February would be dedicated to neighbors, I decided, and I thought of a dozen names right away. I remember when the owners of our local bookstore let me and my 5-year-old son Henry in before the store opened and offered to play his favorite soundtrack, Mary Poppins. I recalled when our 14-year-old babysitter dropped off a bag of old board games for our kids to play. Writing the notes wasn't all that time-consuming. Each was 2 or 3 sentences long, taking just a few minutes to compose. I focused on the person I was writing to and what I wanted to say, and the words came fairly easily. I quickly learned I couldn't do it while listening to a podcast or toggling between articles. That focus felt refreshing. It was good for my brain, which had been trained to wander, alighting on this feed or that email, darting from app to app. It felt meditative to look at a blank white space with a pen in my hand, thinking about a person and the way he or she had helped me. While writing the notes, I eventually realized why this task was perfect antidote to my social feeds. What was I actually doing when I scrolled through Facebook? Too often I was spiraling into rage. Writing thank you notes was time spent on something purely positive. What was I doing when I scrolled through Instagram? More often than not, I was admiring other people's lives, their beach vacations, their chubby babies, their organized kitchens. Writing thank you notes was an act of noticing and honoring my own life. After handing the first batch of notes to my neighbors, I spent a few days trying to remember times when other neighbors did something nice for me. And funny enough, I started noticing kindnesses that were happening in real time. There was a driver who waited for me as I belted down the street to catch his shuttle bus. There was a cashier at Trader Joe's who chased me with a bag of groceries I'd left behind. On the day I delivered that card to the Trader Joe's, my mother-in-law Louise dropped off a week's worth of dinners. Okay, I thought. Louise is not technically a neighbor, but if I was going to thank Grocer Pete for 3 minutes of his time, I needed to acknowledge Louise for hours of hers. It was important for these months to be flexible. I decided I would use each month's theme as a starting point, but I'd also watch for anyone going above and beyond, regardless of whether he or she felt into the monthly theme. So in the ensuing months, as I wrote to friends, doctors, career mentors, and parenting role models, I also dashed off misses to my husband, Jake, as well as my siblings, in-laws, and parents. And I found that doing so changed the fundamental dynamics of these relationships in small but impactful ways. I was smoothing out any prickly bumps and buffing them to a new shine. It is a powerful thing I learned to fully appreciate and feel fully appreciated by the people closest to you. By the time I got to July, my food month, I had become fairly adept at retrieving memories and identifying people to thank you. Among that month's recipients was a chef, Julie, who had cooked at my favorite but now defunct restaurant. Here's what I wrote to her. Dear Julie, I've been finding myself missing Little Giant lately, as if it were a person. Thank you for creating such a warm, special place, and for hosting me and cooking beautiful and thoughtful food. The Little Giant menu has informed my cooking. I am always trying to recreate some of that magic. Jake and I will never forget when you sent out biscuits shaped into the Roman numeral 6 for our 6th anniversary. We talk about it every year. Thank you. We miss Little Giant and you. Love, Gina. I was delighted to receive a note back from her. Julie replied, I don't think I've ever received such a touching letter before. Out of the blue and incredibly thoughtful, and so needed at a time when I'm struggling professionally. Your letter was a fabulous reminder that looking back is a good motivator of moving forward. It was one of many responses throughout the year that said something along the lines of, I'm going through a tough time right now, and this helped. Turns out a lot of people are going through something a lot of the time, and I wouldn't have known that if I hadn't reached out. Part of the magic of what am I calling my thank you year was reconnecting with people like Julie, people on the periphery of my life who nevertheless made a lasting impact. And here's another huge bonus. I was reminded to acknowledge people in the moment, too, to smile or say hello or thanks or here, let me help you with that. I admit, I fell behind more than once during the year, but I completed my goal with hours to spare. Writing my last card to Jake on December 31st. Thank you. That night, we hosted a big New Year's Eve dinner, and I looked around at my guests. There was Alonzo from Berlin, whom I'd written to in my travel month. There were Nick and Ro in from Minneapolis, who'd received cards to my friends and career mentors months. There was Molly, who racked up notes as a mentor, friend, and neighbor. There was Jake, of course. Henry had fallen asleep on the couch. His brother Charlie was upstairs in bed. I snapped a picture of the scene so I can remember the feeling welling up inside me. Gratitude. How to write a better thank you note. Don't bother to buy expensive cards. Don't take a preliminary outline. It's fussy and takes too long. Do spend a minute or two focus on the recipient before you start writing. Don't worry about crafting poetic or perfect sentences. Do speak from the heart. Do clear away distractions. Turn off the TV and phone while you're writing. Don't fret about your messy handwriting. If you make an error, just cross it out. Don't expect a response, but enjoy a grateful surprise when you receive one. A low point for pizza lovers. Pie fans, let's never go back to 2018. That's the year emergency room visits for pizza-related injuries nationwide skyrocketed. Whether someone slashed a finger with a pizza cutter or tripped walking down some stairs during a delivery, this cheesy Italian meal proved to be a hazardous one. Other reported incidents include a man who poked the roof of his mouth with a fork while eating pizza. Who eats pizza with a fork? And a woman who swallowed her tongue ring along with her slice. Inspiration. And there's a picture of a young family here. A man, a woman, and three boys. The author with his wife, Brianna, and their children. William, far left, 3, and twin, Charles and Jack, 6. And the title of this piece is, we moved to the worst place in America. It started out as something of a joke, almost a dare. We've been living here for 4 years now. What was it that stopped the train that day? Signal problems? Wet leaves? A body on the tracks? Whatever it was, the train was running late again, which meant I'd be an hour, maybe two, maybe three, late to work again, which meant I'd be staying late and not getting home until long after the kids had gone to bed. Again. I was well into my second year writing for the Washington Post, a dream job by any measure, except for one tiny problem. The Post is based in Washington, D.C. My wife, Brianna, and I, along with our two-year-old twins, Jack and Charles, live just outside of Baltimore. Between our home and the Post newsroom lay about 80 miles of commute, 90 to 120 minutes by car, train, subway, and foot, on a good day. That damp August morning in 2015, not shaping up to be a good day. But what choice did I have, given that the median home value in Washington, D.C. is somewhat north of $500,000, which was well out of the realm of affordability for Brianna, who worked for the Social Security Administration, and me. We knew we had to do something about our situation, but no matter how far outside the box we started to think, we couldn't make the numbers add up. Then, later that summer, I wrote an article that would change my life. I had stumbled across an obscure project of the U.S. Department of Agriculture examining the physical characteristic that most people would agree made a place pleasant to live in. Things like hills, valleys, bodies of water, nice weather. The product ranked America's 3,000 counties from ugliest to the most scenic. Ventura County, California came in at number one on the list, not surprising given the shore, the hills, the temperate climate. The county that came in last was a little place I'd never heard of called Red Lake County, in the northwest corner of Minnesota. It turns out that Red Lake County doesn't have any actual lakes or any hills. The summers are hot and the winters are brutally cold. You crunch all those numbers together on a spreadsheet and you wind up with the worst place to live in America. My story went up on the Washington Post website at 9:27 on Monday morning. By 9:32, the hate mail started rolling in. By mid-morning, people had started sending the photographs of golden wheat fields, meandering rivers, and deep blue prairie skies. This is what the worst place in America to live in looks like in the late summer, one of them said. The photographs eventually morphed into a hashtag campaign. Show me your ugly counties. In a lighthearted attempt at making amends, I rounded up a bunch of the best responses and published them in the follow-up piece called Thick Coats, Thin Skins, why Minnesotans were outraged by a recent Washington Post report. Shortly after, I got an email with the subject line, an invitation to come visit Red Lake County. It was from a guy named Jason Bromwell. His family, he wrote, owned a river tubing business based in Red Lake Falls, the county seat, with a population of 1,427. I would like to cordially and officially invite you to come and check out our little county, which has now been dubbed the worst county in the United States, he said. I would also like to reassure you that you'll be given plenty of good-natured ribbing, but would be greeted with open arms and a lot of people showing you why they feel our county is far from the worst. And there's a picture here of prevalence of natural amenities making each county a nice place to visit. And it's actually interesting. The average is, it looks like North Carolina, the eastern part, not the coast, but the eastern part of North Carolina, has a below average as a good place to live. But the central part, which is, of course, Raleigh, Durham, that area there, is basically average. The highest places are South Florida and California. Don't forget, this is natural amenities, not good life as far as work and stuff is concerned. But anyway, Red Lake County, Minnesota is really up north. Unsurprisingly, warm and sunny spots are the nicest place to live, according to USDA's index. A few days later, I was on a plane. The closest major airport, with just two gates, is in Grand Forks, North Dakota, 40 miles away. As I flew in, the view outside the airplane window was a rigid grid, straight roads stretching out to the horizon, interrupted only by other straight roads running perpendicular. Everything was flat, square. It certainly looked to be America's worst place to live. By the way, when I was serving in Vietnam, we ran into a lot of people from the Air Force who had actually volunteered for Vietnam after they were stationed in in North Dakota. So that area is not exactly the most popular place to live. I had done some reading to find out what kind of place I'd be parachuting into. By most economic measures, the county seemed to be doing okay. The unemployment rate that July was 4.4%, well below the national average. The median household income was $48,000, less than half the typical income in the Washington suburbs where I lived. The median home value, on the other hand, was $89,000, or one-fifth the typical home price in our area. The county was home to just a hair over 4,000 people, 95% of whom were white. The median age was 42. The big business was farming. Just 1.6% of the land was devoted to towns and residences. It was home to approximately twice as many cows as people. A picture was starting to emerge in my head of a place not unlike the hardscrabble farming communities that surrounded Orin, Onondaga, New York, where Brianna and I had grown up. Jason Bromwell had warned me to prepare for a huge helping of Minnesota nice. At his suggestion, I took the back way from Grand Forks to Red Lake Falls. What struck me wasn't the flatness or the emptiness or the complete lack of people or cars. It was the sky. Unencumbered by hills and valleys, the sky seemed impossibly vast to my East Coast eyes. A clear blue dome dotted by puffy clouds straight out of a children's book. The horizon was only truly infinite, the size and scale of space and openness almost humbling. A large wooden sign proclaimed, "Welcome to Red Lake Falls," and there weren't just a handful of people waiting to meet me. As Jason had suggested, there were dozens, including four or five camera crews and a color guard from the high school. Jason and his dad, Dick Brumwell, found me, and after a quick press conference, they loaded me and a gaggle of reporters and local luminaries onto a roofless red bus, one of the fleet they used to ferry tubers to the river launch, and took us to a dairy farm owned by brothers Carl and Joe Schlender. Carl asked me whether I wanted to check out the inside of the barn. I said, yes, of course I did. I had some experience with dairy farms growing up. My dad was a large animal veterinarian, and in my childhood I would ride around to farms with him in lieu of daycare or any other more structured and costly activity. When we got to the farm, I bounded off the bus and made my way over to the calf pens. A newborn calf suckled my thumb as the Schindler brothers told me about the life on the farm. A member of one of the camera crews tried to follow us into the barn, but ended up retching, overcome by the smell. "Smells great to me," I said. "Smells like home." The next activity was a kayak ride down the Red Lake River. The river was tranquil, carving deep meanders through the landscape. Dusty cliffs rose up one side and then the other, pocked with holes where swallows nested. Afterwards, I stopped by my motel room to get a shower before dinner at T&J's, the local bar and grill. The folks at T&J's were outgoing and eager to talk about what made their community so special. Al Buse, for instance, who at 101 was the oldest resident of Red Lake Falls, and like everyone's grandma, Jason told me, Al was the grandson of one of the town's original founders, and he was, it seemed, the living, breathing avatar of what made the town tick. Every morning, when the weather was nice, he would load his tools into the back of his bright yellow golf cart and make his way through town, fixing things that needed fixing, watering plants, generally doing whatever he could to keep the town tidy. When I settled in for the night, I let Brianna know I was safe, untarred, and unfeathered. I had dozens of Facebook notifications, friend requests from Minnesotans I had met earlier in the day. Minnesota nice, indeed. The next day, Jason showed up for a bus, up in a bus with a sign reading America's Worst Tour, displayed above the windshield. We visited a wheat farm in Brooks, population 139, where fourth-generation farmer Alex Yagi let me drive his combine. We stopped at an asparagus farm and sampled from a jar of fiercely flavored pickled asparagus. We stopped at the Plummer Area Sportsman Club, where County Commissioner Chuck Simpson, who said in response to my original story that I could kiss his butt, showed me around the shooting range. Spent a little bit of time at Red Lake County, and you'll notice the people here are highly invested in their community. See that little park with the gazebo on Main Street? Dick Brumbell built it as a memorial to his late wife. See the garden on the hill across the street from the county courthouse? That's a project of the local Lions Club. And that train-shaped light display on the old railroad trestle during the holiday? That's the brainchild of Jim Benoit, who thought people should have something nice to look at when they drive into town. People rarely lock their doors in Red Lake County. even when they're not home. People trust each other so much that they often leave their cars running with the keys in ignition when they run into Brits to pick up some groceries. Kids often run around unsupervised well into the evening hours. Not a problem when you trust the folks in your neighborhood to keep an eye out for any trouble. And there's a picture of the author and a sign that said Red Lake County, and he's got a big thumbs up. When I returned home, Brianna noticed that I wouldn't stop talking about how great the people were. Their warmth, their friendliness, their determination to make their community better. Jammed into a hot, overcrowded train, I could add 5 minutes to his 50, I'm sorry, I could add, I apologize, skip the line there. I thought of the guy who complained about how getting stuck behind a tracker could add 5 minutes to his 15-minute commute. When I told people in Red Lake Falls that sometimes I spent 5 hours a day commuting to and from work, their jaws often dropped. They had their own trials and headaches, of course. Downtown wasn't what it had once been. Affordable health care was a challenge. The sheriff's office had the occasional speeder or shoplifter to deal with. But the people were rising up to meet their challenges. When the town pool needed work, they held a carnival and other events to pull together $70,000. Once I was back at the grind in D.C., and my days in Red Lake County took on a positively Norman Rockwellian cast, the pressures of modern life seemed manageable there, and I wanted to take my family to a place with wide-open spaces of possibility, with room to breathe. I wondered what the people in Red Lake County seemed to have. One weekend, my mom and stepdad flew in from Tampa to visit. The boys were in bed, and the four adults were unwinding in our tiny living room. Brianna and I were talking through all of these issues. The hope, the house, the jobs, the commute, and how we couldn't find a way out of any of it. My mom said, "Well, what if you moved to that nice little Minnesota town Chris visited over the summer?" We all laughed. "No, really," she said. The room went quiet. For me, in that moment, suddenly all the pieces fell into place. One of us could work from home. The other could take a break from working to be with the kids, which we could afford given the low cost of living. Over the next few days, a plan gradually came into focus. Once my bosses approved my request to work remotely, it was official. We sat down with the boys in two and a half, and said, "We're going to live in Minnesota." "Minnesota?" they said. They had no idea what it meant, but the word soon became a universal totem of anticipation in the house, encompassing all of our hopes, dreams, and anxieties, our struggle for a better life. Minnesota. The following May, we moved to Red Lake Falls. Our family, me, Brianna, Jack, Charles, Tiber, our 70-pound Beagle Basset mix, and Ivy, our 12-year-old cat, arrived on a Sunday. The closing on the house was scheduled for the following day, but the previous owners, the Kleins, told us they'd leave the door open and the keys on the kitchen counter. We hadn't even gotten the kids out of their car seats before we were enthusiastically greeted by our new neighbor, who wanted to know whether we played any instruments because there was a great little community band and they were always looking for new players. The Brumwells and the Kleins came over to help us get all our stuff out of the moving van. A few neighbors wandered over to pitch in as well, and with their help we wrapped up the job in just a couple of hours. It was an auspicious beginning, and our family quickly acclimated to the small-town life. Brianna volunteered for the Civic and Commerce Committee and was persuaded to run for city council, an election she handily won. The boys soon thrived under the personal attention at JAU's Elementary. Even Charlie, who was diagnosed with autism and might have gotten lost in a crowd of a larger public school like the one we had left in Maryland. Most of the things we missed, including curry paste, sparkling wine, and books the tiny library doesn't offer, we were able to order online or ask local proprietors to stock for us. We found plenty of culture and diversity, though we had to actively seek it out rather than experiencing the world simply by walking down the street, the way you can in a big city. The twins, now six, had spent more birthdays in Minnesota than they did in Maryland, and we have another son, William, who is three. I can honestly say that there would have been no William had we not moved to Red Lake Falls. It's my job to write about data. I'm a big believer in its power. But out of our relocation has been a humbling reminder of the limitations of numbers. It has opened my eyes to all the things that get lost when you abstract people, places, and points in time down to a number on a computer screen. Yes, the Governor's National Amenities Index accurately captures the flatness of the Midwestern farm country, the summer heat, the bitter winter cold, but it misses so much about the landscape, the sound of the breeze rustling the grain, or the way the wheat catches the light, the dry, sweet smell of a field of sunflowers. It doesn't tell you how a family can keep itself warm through the coldest of winters by building igloos and sledding down the town hill, or how the vast winter night sky shines with the light of a thousand stars that people who live in the cities will never know. It doesn't tell you about the heat put off by a big roaring fire in a park at the darkness time of the year, how the glow dances on the faces of those gathered around. The people of Red Lake Falls bring light to the darkness and warmth to the cold. Glancing around the bonfire at last winter's train lighting ceremony, when everyone clapped and cheered, it felt certain. We were home. Blue Moon. NASA was so concerned that Apollo 12 astronaut Charles Pete Conrad would start cussing during the live transmission from the moon that they hypnotized him without telling him. In transcripts from that voyage, which occurred 50 years ago, last November, Conrad is humming, dum-dee-dum-dum-dum, when his brain wanted to say, weird and wonderful inventions. From a bicycle that rides on water to a pillow that stops you from snoring, these 18 innovations will blow your mind and a hole in your wallet. For years, Donna has been desperate to get a good night's sleep. The problem? Her husband. He snored, like a freight train. Donna tried the standard fixes, earplugs for her, uncomfortable and ineffective, mouth guards and or nose gizmos for him, ditto, and shoving him again and again and again, ditto. Then she heard about a really out-there solution called the motion pillow. Made by Korean company Ten Minds, the pillow has four pressure-setting airbags that connect to an outside microphone on a nightstand. Once the mic detects her hubby shaking the shingles, it automatically inflates the airbags, which gently reposition his head until he stops sawing logs. Donna doesn't always go for the expensive gadgets, inexpensive ones or another matter, but when she heard the motion pillow won an Innovations Award 2020 from the Consumer Technology Association, she decided to take the $378 plunge. And it works. In fact, when she's mad at her husband, she makes snoring sounds just so the pillow will take his head on a roller coaster ride. These days, her husband's snoring no longer wakes Donna up. Some strange woman does. Morning, champ. Remember, all our dreams can come true if we have the courage to pursue them. Who is this ridiculously peppy morning person? It's Donna's new alarm clock. Bitten by the gadget bug, Donna bought Rugi for $69. It's the only clock that gets her out of bed, quite literally. First, it rouses her using music. Those piercing words of affirmation or an alarm that can hit 120 decibels, a din akin to a pneumatic drill. When Donna reaches for the snooze button, she is confronted by the fact that the Rugi doesn't have one. To make it stop, she has to haul herself out of bed and stand on a foam mat. The rug and Rugi, it's spelled Rugi, not Rugi, R-U-G-G-I-E, for up to 30 seconds. At that point, she is soundly awake. Now that you know all about Donna's sleeping habits, there's something else you should know about her. She's not real. But all the devices she encounters in this story are. A few are still in the developmental stage, but most are available right now. They might not change the world in your life, but they are delightful in their own quirky ways. Even if you wouldn't benefit from owning, say, a robot designed to help out in the bathroom, more of that below, it's awfully fun to read about the weird things that marketers and inventors are coming up with. Which brings us back to Donna. As it happens, she has high cholesterol, and her weakness for bacon doesn't help. Fortunately, a professor at England's hallowed University of Oxford is developing the bacon patch. It's a nicotine-style patch you wear on your arm, scratches, and it releases an amount and aroma redolent of fatty bacon goodness. Studies have shown that SET can reduce food cravings, insists its creator, Charles Spence. Really? That smells fairly fishy to some skeptics. If I could smell bacon, one for bacon eater told the Telegraph. I'm sorry, this is so funny. Sold the Telegraph when it reported on the faux pro-con product. I want to eat bacon. Donna's actually healthy breakfast is a non-earth-shattering bowl of honey-treated Kunza cereal from Cascadian Farms, developed by Kansas nonprofit Land Institute. Kunza, that's K-E-R-N-Z-A, is a new grain that has been touted as a possible savior for our warming planet. Because it's perennial, unlike wheat, oats, and barley, it sucks greenhouse gases from the air and traps them in its roots, much like a tree. It also soaks up nitrogen, a fertilizer ingredient that has been blamed for polluting streams and rivers. Not a cereal person? Patagonia Provision makes beer with Kernza. Talk about the breakfast of champions. I don't know who wrote this, but they sure are hilarious. Also, Kernza is high in fiber, so as often the bathroom Donna goes. Poop anxiety is real, a spokesman for Charmin, the toilet paper brand, told CNN. And Donna agrees, especially when, after conducting her business, she realizes she's out of toilet paper. She calls her husband, but of course he's still asleep. So she fires up the Charmin app on her phone, and the robot comes to rescue. Using infrared sensors, the self-balancing robot embedded with a teddy bear face arrives, bearing the precious roll of preloaded toilet paper. Alas, Charmin has only made one robot so far. And I have a question. How does the robot open the bathroom door? Saved by the robot, Donna continues to get ready for her day. She opens her dresser drawer and pulls out a pair of Sensoria Smart Socks. The socks, $199. Oh, my God. Have a dock for, that's a quote, by the way, it's in print. Have a dock for microelectronic chip that wirelessly relays data about the cadence, pace, heart rate, and more to an app on Donna's phone. You can't wear low-tech shoes with high-tech socks, so Donna also brought a $400 pair of self-lacing sneakers. The Adept BB 2.0, which were created by Nike for athletes, NBA star Ja Morant of the Memphis Grizzlies wore them. All Donna needs to do is insert her foot into the sneaker, and the digital sensor inside the sole does the rest by deducing her foot size and automatically closing around it. Donna may be in good shape, but her pudgy pets could use some help. For her dog, she bought the iFetch, $115. A small blue and white machine that sits on the floor and automatically launches a tennis ball up to 30 feet. The dog retrieves the ball and drops it into the hole at the top, and if the fetch launches it again. When cats dream, they envision themselves prowling the Serengeti, stalking wildebeest. So Donna bought Kitty, the ProFlight Panther cat toy drone. As the name implies, it's a drone. But this $100 novelty flies around the room, dangling a small toy for the cat to chase. It even has a built-in camera so Donna can watch Kitty from her phone. Donna's not concerned about the damage a drone might cause indoors, because CertiPet assures her that the safety features, including a condition avoidance system and auto altitude, help protect you from the flying drone into your cat or surroundings. Before leaving the house, Donna stops to write a note to her hubby. She reaches for a pad and her favorite pen ever, the Air Ink from Gravelicki. The pen, available only as a prototype, literally writes with polluted air from captured carbon emissions. A cylindrical device called K-Link fits around the cat's tail pipe. The pits around a car's tailpipe and captures up to 99% of its black particulate matter, which in turn is converted into ink and paints. Pollution is bad, Gravity co-founder Andrea Sharma told Time magazine, but pollution happens to be a really good raw material to make ink. Donna opens the door to a beautiful day. If she were wearing Moho lenses, a smart augmented reality AR contact lens from Mojo Vision, she knew it was 72 degrees outside because the lens would tell her. Donna has been coveting one for a while, though it's not for sale yet. The lens is activated by eye movement and powered by a minuscule battery that lives on the lens itself. Microelectronics are used to project images on the tiniest of built-in displays. Users can call up information, scroll through text, and even watch videos. Because the technology fades away when you want to focus on the world around you, says Mojo Vision CEO Drew Perkins, the lens hides whatever was being displayed. It makes walking the busy streets safe, unlike when you're looking at your smartphone, which luckily Donna doesn't happen to be doing at the moment, or else she would have been clipped by a speeding suitcase grinning for her at 6 miles per hour. That's right. Created by a Chinese company called Forward K Robotics, the Ovis suitcase, $640, is a self-prepared carry-on that uses cameras, facial recognition technology, and a tracking algorithm to handle travel hands-free with its owner, avoiding collisions as it wends its way through crowds. Essentially, says Nicholas Chi, founder and CEO of ForwardX, we're given Ova's suitcase, a pair of eyes and a brain. It's like luggage and a pet all in one, but you don't have to pick it up after the, you don't have to pick up after the suitcase. The Ovis does a U-turn and returns to Donna, this time accompanied by its owner, a German tourist. He hosts two ambassador earpieces, audio devices with built-in microphones, that translate on the spot. He puts one earpiece over his ear, and Donna does the same with the other. He asks in German how to get to the train station, but Donna hears the question in English. She responds in English, and he nods, understanding everything, since her words are relayed in German. The two could have a spoken in Japanese, Mandarin, or Hebrew. The ambassador translates 26 languages and 42 dialects. Donna bids the tourist and his Ovis auf Wiedersehen and then walks to her favorite restaurant and grabs a table. Minutes later, her friend enters the eatery wearing stylish sunglasses. Elaine, Donna calls out. Elaine slowly walks over and takes a seat without assistance, remarkable because she is blind. Since she was fitted with the Orion Visual Cortical Prosthesis System from California-based Second Sight, we've actually had experience here with those. She has led a more active life. Those stylish sunglasses carry a camera and video processing unit, VPU, implanted in the visual cortex of Elaine's brain is a tiny chip containing 60 electrodes. The wireless VPU converts images from the camera into electrical pulses, which are transmitted to the electrodes on Elaine's brain, which then figures out what she is looking at. People and objects appear as dots of light. You don't even have to have eyes for the device to work, says Nader Puran, M.D., Ph.D., a neurosurgeon at Ronald Reagan UCLA Medical Center, who has implanted a device in patients. Elaine was sold when she learned that from 10medium.com that a participant in a clinical trial was able to see his birthday candles for the first time in more than 7 years. The waitress comes by and Elaine orders an impossible burger, tempted by a bacon cheeseburger at the near table. Donna wishes again that she had that bacon patch. Instead, she orders a salad, and the two chat away. Elaine brags about the vacation her son Mark took. He rode a bicycle across a lake. Well, not exactly. He rode a Manta 5 Hydrofoiler XE bike, which Digital Trends calls the unholy offspring of a boat, an airplane, and an e-bike. It also has an unholy price tag, $8,990, instead of wheels. And the Manta is equipped with a set of hydrofoils, which essentially function like wings in the water. As you pedal and propel the bike forward, water passes through these wings and creates lift, much like an airplane wings create lift. One customer review swears, it really is like flying on water. After lunch, Donna leaves Elaine to run an errand. As she's crossing the street, she gets a text from her husband. How do I turn off the you-know-what lights? How do I turn off the iFetch? With her head buried in her phone, she texts back, I'm coming home. Donna's irreformable T-walker, someone who texts while walking, and this time it's not a suitcase but a car that almost gets her. She knows she has a dangerous habit, pedestrian deaths or climbing, but is unhappy about the protection on the way. Fred Yang, professor of electrical engineering at Columbia University, is working out the kinks of smart headphones. When they're perfected, four miniature microphones will differentiate car sounds from background noise, says Mashable.com, and work with an app to calculate the distance and position of cars in order to alert wearers when they are in danger of being run over. Sounds wonderful to Donna. Back home, she switches off the iFetch and joins her frazzled husband on the couch to watch TV. But the screen is nowhere in sight. Donna taps a button on a remote, and a 65-inch screen unfurls from a rectangular bus box sitting on a stand, emerging gloriously like an entertainment cobra from a basket, says CNET.com. It's an early version of the not-yet-available LG Signature OLED TV R9. Kept erect by numerous thin horizontal bars and a pair of riser arms set into its back, the screen can be raised some 50,000 times before potentially breaking down from wear, according to LG. Donna's husband puts an arm around her, overcome with love for him, is snoring at all. She wants to tell him how she feels, but their smart speakers and virtual assistants, such as Amazon Echo or Google Home, may be listening. So she opens a coffee table drawer, pulls out Bracelet of Silence, and slips it on her wrist. The brainchild of Ben Zhou and Heather Zeng, married computer science professors at the University of Chicago, this piece of digital armor, as the New York Times calls it, will jam the Echo and any other microphones in the vicinity from listening in on the wearer's conversations. But not yet on sale, the large clunky plastic cuff is dotted with 24 small speakers that email imperceptible ultrasonic signals to jam prying microphones. Asper whispering sweet nothings to her husband's ear, Donna calls up an Amazon Prime Video and orders a classic, Casablanca. Sometimes the old stuff is still the good stuff. That was fun. But now we're going to do something a little more serious, health and medicine. 20 pains to never ignore. We all feel a twinge once in a while. When it is no big deal, when it is a warning sign that something needs attention now. Maybe you feel your feet have started to tingle every so often, or you developed a mild fever. Nothing to worry about, right? Maybe. But given the coronavirus disease, COVID-19 pandemic, you don't have to be a hypochondriac to think hard about whether a niggling symptom is a clue that something more serious is happening in your body. How can you tell when to shrug and when to panic? These stories feature people who faced that quandary and discovered that their discomfort emanated from conditions far different from what they suspected. The welcome result, after a proper diagnosis, they each get the treatment they needed, considering their journeys to be a guide for us all. Abdominal pain. The burning sensation turned out to be colon cancer. When Abidraman Salacido felt a burning sensation in her abdomen in the summer of 2017, she ignored it for 4 or 5 months. I have 3 kids and was just busy with life, says the high school guidance counselor, who was 47 at the time. After the pain moved to her back, I Googled my symptoms and decided it must be an ulcer. So I changed my diet to bland food, she calls. Then she began losing weight rapidly. Further Googling showed that her abdominal pain and weight loss were both classic signs of colorectal cancer, often called colon cancer. But Driven Celeso dismissed the possibility because she felt she was too young. By the time she made it to the doctor's office, she had dropped 25 pounds. Her gastroenterologist did blood work and x-rays, but everything came back normal. He prescribed medication for irritable bowel syndrome. After taking it for a few weeks with no relief, Driven Celeso called the doctor again. On the way to the CT scan he ordered, I told my husband, this must be what caused cancer feels like. I'm in so much pain. The scan showed a shadow on her liver. A followed-up colonoscopy revealed the truth. She didn't have colorectal cancer. Driven Celeso had 3 days of chemotherapy every week for a year. The treatment caused beautiful side effects, including sleepless nights and weakness and numbness in her hands and feet. But it was worth it. The treatment wiped out her tumor. Unfortunately, Driven Celoso is now battling a new tumor in her liver. Still, having beat cancer once, she is optimistic that she could do it again. And she says, I'm now vigilant about listening to my body and taking care of myself. What else could it be? We all have tummy troubles once and again, now and again. But belly pain sometimes signals serious conditions. A sharp pain in the lower right side of the abdomen could be a bell appendicitis. Not for me, I lost mine. In the lower left, diverticulitis. In the middle of the upper right, gallstones. And closer to the pelvis, ovarian cyst or urinary tract infection. Dull or burning pain or cramping is sometimes caused by an ulcer, irritable bowel syndrome, or an inflammatory bowel disease such as Crohn's or ulcerative colitis. Stomach aches accompanied by fever could be viogastritis. Mouth problems. My insatiable thirst turned out to be diabetes. Carol G. stood at the car rental desk at Rapid City Regional Airport in South Dakota and began to tell the agents her last name. That's when she noticed her mouth had gone completely dry. Finding it hard to speak, she finished the paperwork and handed her husband the keys. G., 59 at the time, said she tried not to panic. It was the weirdest feeling I've ever had. There was no moisture in my mouth whatsoever. She attributed to the city's elevation and the long flight she had just taken, though the dry mouth became a feeling of endless thirst. Water wasn't helping at all. I drank and drank. That led to using the restroom constantly. I was miserable the whole day. A few months earlier, she had a checkup with her doctor and had noticed that G's blood glucose level was higher than usual, says G. Since she didn't offer medication, I assumed it wasn't a big deal. Though she did her best to enjoy her stay, She remembers the fatigue that had hit her on the way home. Walking from the airport to our car, it took every bit of strength I had to pull my carry-on luggage. It was so hard to put one foot in front of the other. The next day, she called her doctor, who recommended a trip to the emergency room. When they tested my blood glucose, the doctor said, "You have type 2 diabetes, and you're in bad shape. Your glucose level is so high, it's a wonder you're not in a diabetic coma or worse." That's when it hit me how serious it was. When G was admitted, her blood glucose was 900 milligrams, a long way from normal result of less than 140 milligrams. Wow, 900 is awful. Now 70, G says she's obsessive about taking her insulin and testing her blood. I wish I had been more proactive and asked my doctor about high glucose level when she first found it. I would have found out to take my blood sugar. Put a note to that cake, my blood sugar never would have gotten that high. And this all wouldn't have been such a surprise, she says. What else could it be? Smell something funky when you open your mouth? If you had white spots on your tongue, it could be an oral yeast infection or a tumor. If your breath smells like sour milk, it might be lactose intolerant. Like nail polish remover, you're probably eating too much protein. Red lesions on the tongue, loose teeth, canker sores, or red or white patches inside the mouth that longer than 2 weeks could signal cancer. White, yellow, or brown spots on your teeth might indicate celiac disease. A glossy red gum is a sign of vitamin B12 deficiency. You know, I hate to say it, but these things could, for a hypochondriac would be in ecstasy reading all these symptoms. Think of how many you could imagine. Not that they're not serious, but it does seem a little weird. Now, here's one that's particularly urgent. My cold turned out to be COVID-19. Early this year, 20-year-old Jonah Silverman, an author and public speaker, traveled to Thailand, South Korea, Australia, and England. On a flight home to Minneapolis, he says, "I had a minor sore throat and cough." News about the spread of coronavirus 19 was just breaking then, but at the time it seemed to be affecting mostly older people, so he didn't think that could be what he had. Pardon me, we had a pause here. "I don't get sick often. I work out 6 days a week, and I have a very clean diet," he explained. Still, because he has family members with underlying conditions that he heard could raise the risk of complications or death from the virus, he called his doctor the next day. "Once they heard of all the places I had been," Stillman said, "the doctor definitely wanted to test me. They met me at the back door of the office and for personal protective equipment and led me to a room. The entire process took about 15 minutes. That was on a Wednesday. That Saturday, he received the news that he had tested positive for COVID-19. He was one of the first cases diagnosed in Minnesota. It was shocking because he was still relatively new. It still seemed like a foreign issue," he says. "By Sunday, his sore throat had worsened considerably. His violent coughs would not stop, and his fever spiked to 103 degrees. The body aches were unlike anything I've experienced. I could barely move. Among the most disturbing symptoms was his lack of taste and smell. I couldn't differentiate between cake and pizza. The texture was the same, and there was absolutely no taste. I had to force myself to eat because my gag reflex was so strong. I didn't attribute it to COVID-19 originally, but now I see that it's one of the defining symptoms," Stillman says. His recovery took 2 full weeks, and Stillman started to tell his story as a way of urging young people to take the disease and social distancing seriously. "Even if you don't have symptoms, this impacts other families and individuals," he says. What else could it be? Coughs can linger a long time, but if you persist without another cold symptoms, you might have acid reflux, chronic bronchitis, heart failure, pneumonia, or lung or throat cancer. ACE inhibitors and beta blockers taken for high blood pressure can also cause a cough. Generally, if you're coughing up blood or green or yellow phlegm, let your doctor know. Numbness and tingling. My numb feet turned out to be MS. Kathy Chester was fresh out of college, making a name for herself in Manhattan. When she noticed numbness and dangling in her feet, she attributed it to stress and walking long city blocks in cold weather. "I chose to ignore the symptoms, and they grew increasingly worse," she says. When the numbness began to move up her lower legs, Chester decided to go get some medical advice. The doctor told her shoes were too tight. She bought larger shoes, but deep down she knew that was wrong. The numbness progressed toward her knees and thighs, causing her to stumble. A few times she was even accused of being drunk. Along with weakness, fatigue overtook her. "I figured I was exhausted from living on my own and trying to keep up a competitive job market. It felt like I had the flu, but 1,000 times worse, recalls Chester, who was working as a copywriter at the time. One evening, when on her way to catch the bus home, she says, I looked down and saw that one of my high heels had come off 10 feet behind me. I didn't even notice it because my feet were so numb. That was a real wake-up call. After a neurologist ordered a spinal tap, a CT scan, and an MRI, she finally discovered what had plagued her, multiple sclerosis, MS, a disease of the central nervous system that disrupts the flow of information to the brain. Chester had endured 5 years of numbness, weakness, and fatigue. Still, she says, I was one of the lucky ones who get an immediate diagnosis from the scans. My test results were very clear. That brought a sense of relief because I finally knew what to do to help myself. Today, Chester, 61, says, I never got the feeling back in my right leg, even after therapy, and the fatigue is awful. I have to take a nap every day, even no matter what. Chester, now a health advocate, looks to the future with hope. It's my mission to educate, inspire, and bring awareness about MS. For so long, none of us had a voice. What else could it be? Pins and needles or a numb feeling is just a sign that part of your body has gone to sleep. But the feeling lingers. It could be a blood clot, a pinched nerve, peripheral neuropathy, often called diabetes. If you have trouble seeing, speaking, or understanding words, you may be having a stroke. A feeling of numbness in the chest that has lasted longer than 30 minutes could be a heart attack, especially if accompanied by dizziness and nausea. Well, I'm going to stop right here on this particular thing. I'll finish it up next week. We have a few seconds left before the closeout, so let's do a couple humor in uniform. Anyone wanting to take a picture on a base's airfield needs a letter from the public affairs, which happens to be me. One day, while out snapping photos, I was stopped by the military police who asked for my letter from public affairs. But I am public affairs, I said. Without a letter from public affairs, we'll have to take your camera. I did the only thing I could do. I pulled a notepad and pen from my bag and wrote a letter giving myself permission to take photos. The MPs read the letter, saluted, and drove off. And with that, we have just about run out of time for today's episode of the Reader's Digest. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thanks so much for listening. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service.